Welcome to Still Scared Talking Children's Horror, a podcast about creepy, spooky, and disturbing children's books, films, and TV. I'm Ren Wednesday.
I'm your co-host, Adam Wybray.
And I'm special guest, Ava Foxfort.
And we're here to talk about the second part of The Final Reckoning, which is the last book in the Deptford Mice series by Robin Jarvis. As you can tell, there have been a few episodes before this, so definitely go back and listen to them in order to get the full effect. A full transcript of this episode will be available, so check the show notes for that. Enjoy! Good morning, my dear exhausted friends.
Hello. Urglist of burgles to you.
It is the time of the midwinter death, isn't it?
And it's been a while.
It's been a while. We've all had a certain amount of life happening.
Life. Sorry, listeners.
Sorry. But, I mean, I don't want to keep the listeners hanging a moment longer, so I need to ask if we have any important Scotch Egg-related news to share.
Oh, God, I can't... the only important... I did read an article about... Waitrose have brought in vegan Scotch eggs, maybe, and that there was some kind of pork pies. I think that was pork pies. I think it was Melton pork pies, and Waitrose are doing vegan pork pies, and then apart from in Melton or something, because it's the home of the pork pie, and there's some kind of outcry about not respecting the dead flesh traditions of Melton.
Yeah, no, I'm sure you couldn't. Someone went to Melton Mowbray recently and was like, "Oh no, you definitely can't have anything other than an immaculate Scotch pie. It must be perfect there."
Back, right?
They did. They didn't get baked into a pie, as far as I know.
They didn't end up as the special stuff.
Not as far as I could tell. I'm trying to think who it was and whether I've actually seen them since. Now you've got me thinking. There was vegan Scotch pie at the cafe that we were at yesterday. But again, a Scotch pie is not a Scotch egg.
No, or a pork pie.
I've really dropped the egg on this one.
The only thing I can half remember is someone saying that there was a posh restaurant in London that was selling venison wrapped Scotch eggs for £20 a pop as your starter.
I am impressed by your commitment to the form and the format, Ren. I will note the last time you made quite the to-do about the Scotch egg related talk, kind of distracting from the amount of plot you had to get through. Before we started recording, you noted how much plot you have written down, so it's going to be somewhat perverse and even masochistic that you have launched into the Scotch egg talk.
Scotch egg news. I do believe we haven't even mentioned the name of the book that we're talking about.
So
renegade intro approach here.
Deptford Mice.
Which one?
The Final Reckoning, part two.
Part two.
Part two.
Or
part
the second two. Half of. There isn't, it isn't actually split into two parts.
No.
It is a single book. There's just a lot of plot in it, and a lot of misery, and a lot of snow.
Yeah. In fact, if you're listening to this, no, there's no way we're going to get this done before the election results.
No.
Yeah, enjoy your misery. But, you know, at least the aesthetics match up, eh?
Okay. I can't think about it, right?
No, that's fair.
So, listeners may recall our intense mid-season finale of Jupiter.
AKA Boris Johnson.
Boris the Unbeast.
The Unbeast.
Lording it up and being very smug.
Using the star glass to put out all hope in Britain. Or light from the stars.
Is the ghost army of rats the Lib Dems, or is that too far? They've been led by their leader to a horrendous trickery to find that they're actually just going to be turned into Tories. Anyway, I mean, spoilers. Either for post-election. negotiations or the book we're talking about.
Sure. I mean, I'm just impressed that, you know, Jarvis was able to anticipate this all in his allegory.
This is going to sound ridiculous if Labour win.
Good, I'll take it.
I will definitely take the small the small embarrassment of the podcast. I think it's worth it on balance.
So we pick it back up with chapter 8, re-enlisting. We're surprised Piccadilly's not dead.
Way. That's good news.
That's good news.
That's good news.
Piccadilly's not dead.
Even though, like, he seemed to die, so I guess he was just concussed or something, right?
Yeah. He's been knocked out and rolled beneath the railway tracks and just sort of lain there for a while.
Like a roly-poly pudding.
Yes.
You shouldn't be eating roly-poly puddings from underneath the railway tracks, Adam.
But his immediate relief at not having been caught by the rats quickly turns to dread as he thinks about Holborn and the great tide of rats that was rushing there. So he approaches the gate of Holborn and corners Barker, demanding to know what happened to the mice inside. Barker sort of wails and pleads and sobs and says that he had nothing to do with it, but tells Piccadilly that the mice stood no chance against old Stumpy's army. And Piccadilly renews his oath that Morgan has to die. And it's a grim sight when we get inside Holborn, where Morgan is perched on the Thane's throne, gloating over the gory destruction his army has caused. And it's really disturbing in terms of Jarvis really going there, as it so does.
Jarvis does not hold back.
So we have this description.
The rats told crude stories and cracked wicked jokes at their victims' expense. Three black-hearted vermin seized some skins and used them as grisly puppets, acting out parts of the battle, relishing the killing and torment. A crowd gathered about them and raucous laughter shook the hall. Nearly everyone took up a mouse fur and placed them on their heads like ghastly hats. They peered through the blank eye holes and poked their tongues out of the mouth spaces. They were a debauched, disgusting sight. Includes its own commentary there, because My word.
I mean, you know.
Yeah.
Realistically, it's not so bad. Like, you know, if...
A bit of skin puppetry.
Well, yeah, exactly. You know, say a group of people were flayed and their skin was used to create, you know, costumes and puppetry, and a kind of performance was put on, kind of restaging this killing, with their very remains, you know, still wet and twitching from the butchery. I don't think it's that big a deal. Just ultimately, you know, I think, okay, you know, fair enough.
Cool.
Okay. Remind me never to accept an invite to a party at yours.
Morgan bends down to drink from his bowl of mice blood. But instead of his own reflection, he sees Jupiter's eyes and hears Jupiter's voice saying that he has come to claim his lieutenant. Morgan tries to struggle against Jupiter's thrall, but he becomes bewitched again and promises that he will bring his new rat army to worship at Jupiter's feet in Deptford. He gathers the rats around and tells them about this, and they're sceptical, but Morgan wins them over with tales of more plump mice to skin and eat. All except Smith and Kelly, who are the rats who are tormenting Barker in the first half of the book, who prepare themselves to take command if Morgan leads them astray. So the rats all stomp out of Holborn, but Piccadilly's still outside, and he thinks he's about to go down in a blaze of glory and maybe scratch one of Morgan's eyes out. But Barker squashes him behind him against the wall so that the parade of rats don't notice Piccadilly behind Barker, which probably wouldn't have worked if it had been anyone but Barker, but the rats are not surprised to see Barker acting peculiarly. Mm. So somehow it works.
Yeah, I found it really intense, this scene. Like, mm. It was like a sneaky bit in Thief or, you know, another stealth game. Yeah, I don't know. I just really like this bit. I found it really suspenseful.
Yeah. We also get the first clue that Barker's not who he makes himself out to be. And that he has some sort of plan for Piccadilly. And it says, "For a moment the rat straightened his back and was unrecognisable, tall and grim with a knowing gleam in his sharp eyes."
Mm.
And when we start to get these little hints, There's something going on with Barker. Piccadilly still has hope that his friend Marty, who he sent to warn Holborn, has escaped the carnage. So Piccadilly goes into Holborn.
He forced himself across the threshold and saw the first victim. It was the sentry, or rather the bits that were left of him. The ancient spear had been seized and taken victoriously away, but the battered tin hat had been too small to fit a rat. All that remained was a crushed lump of bent metal in a dark, grisly pool. In a state of shock, Piccadilly wandered into the entrance hall. The rations were strewn wantonly around, and with overwhelming grief he discovered Agnes Trumper's discarded apron. Small fires crackled here and there, over which little black pots had been hung. Piccadilly was not foolish enough to go and inspect the contents. The smell was enough. He staggered up the passage to the main hall. The rats had scrawled awful, crude pictures daubed in blood on the ancient tiled walkways. The carved pillars had been defaced. All the marvellous wooden animals were now missing ears, legs or heads. And here and there some beast had coarsely whittled shapes of his own and stuck them on with lumps of fat. Piccadilly looked into the chapel of the Green Mouse. It was a wreck, and they had torn down the children's paintings from the walls. It was worse than he could ever have imagined. Here was a love of destruction and baseness he had not thought possible. He stumbled on towards the hall, The tapestry curtain was torn to shreds. Piccadilly stepped over the rags and passed within. The large hall looked like a battlefield. The floor was strewn with well-sucked bones and a pile of skulls was heaped in one corner. Tatters and scraps of fur littered the place, and the huge brewing pans which had been dragged from the kitchens were now capsized, licked clean of mouse broth and ear crisps.
I can't even make a joke out of that one. It's,
it's really, really grim.
I'm kind of tempted by ear crisps, I'll be honest with you.
I have to admit, I've never eaten a mouse.
No,
like, you know, obviously I've been a vegetarian and mostly vegan for, you know, quite a long time. But even as a kid, I don't think I ever plucked a mouse from the garden and ate it, to memory, as far as I know.
Let alone fried up its crisps, its ears as crisps in some broth.
Yeah.
Yeah, you missed out.
Maybe there's a lesson for us in this book, you know.
Did Robin Jarvis ever release a book of mouse
recipes?
How to cook a mouse? To be fair,
that does seem like something that Robin Jarvis would do. If you're listening, Robin, there you go. There's the next book lined up.
Piccadilly almost succumbs to complete despair at this sight, and the comforting maze of lunacy, as Zez, but Barker pulls him back from the brink. Piccadilly realises the rats are going to Deptford, and he speeds off after them, followed by Barker, who's chuckling sinisterly, although we still don't know why. Morgan marches his rat army into the freezing water to swim to Deptford while he rides atop a raft. Piccadilly realises that they'll need a boat as well and commandeers a pudding bowl with a broken wooden spoon and a gull's feather as paddles, and he and Barker paddle wobblingly off into the blizzard.
Yeah, it's very picaresque.
It's very borrowers style.
Yeah, it is actually.
And the description of the rat swim to Deptford is particularly icingly evocative. There's a lot of cold in this book. a lot of very grim winter. You really get a sense of the frozen swim along the river. Morgan and the rats that haven't drowned in the icy river break land in Deptford, which is frozen solid. Smith and Kelly, icicles in their fur, have had enough of Morgan. They confront him, and Morgan cackles triumphantly as he tells them that he's led them to Jupiter. Smith is about to kill Morgan and take leadership, but Morgan tricks the rest of the army into believing that Smith and Kelly were going to betray the rest of them and take the best pickings for themselves. The army unleash their bloodlust on the two rats, and they surge forward with Smith's head on a pole.
They're not nice to each other, are they, even?
No.
Yeah.
They're definitely not.
Yeah, where's the rat camaraderie?
Rat solidarity, it's just not really there, is it?
But I have to say, looking at my Deptford Mice Almanac here, which I say is a brilliant companion piece to the Deptford Mice. I thoroughly recommend it. And it's got bits of kind of rat lore and bat sayings and so forth. But it does say here, infamous maggot rats include Morgan Fletch. And that's because the maggots is a sign of the rat zodiac. And there's a great illustration of this constellation of writhing maggots in the night sky. And it says, Mab is the dark lady of midnight slaughter, yet also the bringer of pestilence, as this constellation reminds us. A rat born at this time will be corrupt and rotten right through, with no redeeming virtue. He is a loner who shifts his allegiance to whoever is in power and must never be trusted. Yet this faithless quality is considered to be a worthwhile trait in this barbaric society, and many rats are proud to be ruled by this particular sign. Infamous maggot rats include Morgan and Fletch.
Typical Geminis? I'm allowed to say that because I am one.
Are you a Gemini?
Yeah, I'm a very, very typical Gemini. Because I don't really believe in the horoscope, but deeply, deeply believe that I'm a very typical Gemini. Which is about as Gemini as I can be. Anyway. Don't think I'm that maggoty, actually.
No.
I like to hope.
You're not a maggot.
Oh, thanks.
So Piccadilly and Barker reach the same ice platform soon after the rats, and Barker wheedles his way to carrying on with Piccadilly while making more remarks that show he's more lucid than he appears when Piccadilly is out of earshot. They reach Deptford Power Station and Piccadilly resolves to go inside, still on his quest to finally kill Morgan. And Morgan, meanwhile, leads his drenched, bone-cold rat army into the power station, which has become an immense cavern of crystals, and finally reveals his plan, calling triumphantly out to Jupiter that he has brought him his subjects. The rats realise they've been tricked and start to turn on him, but just as the first blows rain down on Morgan's head, the giant ice-cold eyes of Jupiter emerge from the ceiling. And all at once, the icicles hanging from the ceiling break and drive themselves into the chest of each rat, rather like a jet of frozen piss from an aeroplane. And as they do, the spell wears off on Morgan and he sees that he's led his triumphant army to their grim deaths in an act of cruelty from Jupiter. And Piccadilly has been watching all of this from the window and scurries away in immense horror. And it's at this point that we come back to Arthur and Thomas Triton, who we last encountered being knocked out by the sheer power of Jupiter.
Jupiter sucking all of the stars out of the sky.
Knocked out by unthinkably awesome horror.
Yeah, pretty much. And they eventually come round and make it back to Deptford and tell the Star Wife and assembled mice what they saw when Jupiter stole the stars. Back in Deptford, there's groups of mice praying to the Green Mouse, but Audrey knows that it's no use because as long as Jupiter is making it always winter and never Christmas, the Green Mouse will never wake up from his hibernation.
Oh, the Green Mouse is much nicer than horrible Aslan. You know, the Green Mouse isn't all scratching at the backs of young girls and condemning other girls who like nylons to go to hell, you know?
Yeah. I know, I think I would rather have the Green Mouse as a deity than Aslan.
Yeah.
The Star Wife tells them that once Jupiter's gathered his strength to use the Starglass again, his next plan will be to steal the sun. And at this point, Piccadilly turns up with Barker, who causes an immense commotion running around and scaring the mice, who are terrified to see a rat.
It is quite enjoyable watching him revel in that, like when he's clearly not supposed to, the general amount of stress that is caused.
Oh. The light relief is Barker menacing.
Barker just assumes that it's all a game. Yeah. Which again, like once we find out that there is more to him than that, like actually becomes intensely creepy. But at this point where it's just like, oh, he's just a crazy old rat. And it's just like, oh, people are running away. Hey, let's play chase.
Like, yeah, was actually almost. He's deep into method.
Yeah. Yes. Very, very deep in method.
Piccadilly catches the Deptford mice up on his story and they have a meeting. Barker reveals that Morgan has Audrey's mouse brass, the cat charm that killed Jupiter in their first battle in the first book. And
So long ago,
can we even cast our minds back that far? The mice catch a glimmer of hope that they could maybe pull the same trick off again. If they can get the mouse brass back from Morgan. We haven't had so far any catch up on our the ongoing thwarted romance between Audrey and Piccadilly, but we get an interlude of that as Gwen Brown catches Audrey making herself pretty for Piccadilly and sadly reminds her that she is a married mouse, even though her marriage to William Scuttle was just a split decision in the moment to save Audrey's life. It's still a legally binding mouse marriage.
Yeah, and like specifically a reason why it was useful was because it was in the eyes of the green mouse, and the green mouse apparently quite strict about this stuff.
Yep. Thomas Triton, Arthur, Piccadilly, and Barker leave Deptford to go and get Audrey's mouse brass from Morgan, and Piccadilly and Audrey struggle to communicate their feelings towards one another. Audrey almost tells Piccadilly everything, but then he has to leave and he goes off to battle, convinced that Audrey doesn't like him after all.
Is that the last... Yeah.
So they're off to the power station and they want to use Barker to draw Morgan out of his fortress, as Barker is someone that Morgan knows and doesn't think is a threat. Barker kind of wails and flails and throws his voice, showing more of his actorly qualities.
Yeah, he's just using the moment as a showcase.
Does a bit of juggling.
And then passes over his resume.
Morgan, with the mouse brass, ventures out into the blizzard, anticipating another easy sacrifice to Jupiter, but ambushed by Piccadilly, and Morgan and Piccadilly fight, and Morgan taunts the mice, saying that Jupiter's grown far too powerful to be defeated by the mouse brass this time. And then we get the return of the rats.
Before him was a host of hideous phantoms. All of Morgan's slaughtered rats had returned in spectral form. Their eye sockets were empty and they stared blankly out at the frozen world. The faces of the apparitions still held the tortured look of their hideous deaths, and hollow wails echoed into the night from their gaping dead mouths. In their haunted claws, each held the spear that had killed him, and the icy spikes were stained black with their own blood.
Damn.
Yeah, I still maintain that this book is the most kind of metal of the three books.
Yeah. Is there a metal concept album on the Deptford Mice?
There really should be, to be honest. Yeah. I think it really would justify that.
I recently got into singing The Rime of the Ancient Mariner by Iron Maiden on Rock Band.
Oh.
Because that's a thing you can do on Rock Band, apparently, is sing 13 minutes of The Rime of the Ancient Mariner by Iron Maiden.
I've been at a party where someone's done a dramatic reading of the whole thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of people got very bored.
I'm just saying that I have a newfound appreciation for overwrought long metal set pieces, and I think this should happen.
yeah.
Thomas slashes at the phantom with his spear, but as he hits the starfire that's burning in its chest, his weapon is transformed into the brittle ice, and the blood in his hand freezes. They try to run, but a ghostly spear slices at Thomas's leg, and the wound is instantly poisoned with a festering frost. They're overwhelmed by the undead army, but Barker, who's once again lucid, throws a can of oil. Thomas lights it on fire, and the ragged line of flames holds up the phantoms just long enough for them to escape. And in one final jab at the heart for Piccadilly, he looks back and finally sees the flag that the undead rat army are bearing as their standard, which is the skin of the grey mouse with a jagged mark of dark fur like a thunderbolt, which is his friend Marty.
See, you know, I think my my best friend Peter, I think he'd be all right with his skin being made into some kind of horrible flag. I think if anything, he would be proud.
I mean, it gets you on the cover of a metal record, doesn't it? Like, at the end of the day, you're going to be a cover star with that, aren't you? if you get flayed by the right people.
It's more interesting than just a book, right? That, you know, it's normally what happens. You know,
normally made into a book.
Well, yeah, you know, like, oh, yeah. My skin's been used for the, you know, binding of the Necronomicon or whatever. Like, you know, I think I'd rather be a flag.
Weirdly, we did actually have a book in Brighton Library that was bound in human skin.
Ah, what?
Yeah, it was part of the Rare Books room. It was one of the old collections, and it was didn't get it out that often. It was hard to get access to, and you weren't allowed to touch it.
Did you ever lick it?
This is probably the only book in Brighton Library that I never licked.
No, good answer.
But one day.
Buddy, they don't even let me lick the book. On seeing that nothing will stop Piccadilly from revenge, he sprints off into the flames, followed by Barker, who had been manipulating their situation all along. And Piccadilly has his final desperate showdown with Morgan, and just as he's poised to kill him, Morgan gives himself up. He tells Piccadilly to just kill him, that it will be a quicker death for him than what Jupiter had in store, and that Piccadilly should give in to the anger and bloodlust within him, because they're not so different after all. And at that, Piccadilly realises what separates him from the rat. He's not a killer, and he believes in the Green Mouse. But as Piccadilly puts his knife down, Morgan grabs it and kills himself with the last words, "This rat's no cat's paw anymore."
It's a strong line.
It's a good line. I mean, yeah, that's the title of one of the songs on this day for sure.
I don't think it's fair.
Really resisting trying to sing it in a Bruce Dickinson voice.
I'm watching over trying to resist.
I'm not going to do it because I can't work out whether I should go for a big whale or the kind of like rat-a-tat delivery. It's quite hard for that.
Piccadilly takes the mouse.
See, this is where we need a patron account, because that would definitely be a patron extra.
Patron extra is us trying to sing lines from this in a Bruce Dickinson Iron Maiden style.
Yeah. That would get the money in.
That would get it.
I just noticed.
Please get in touch if you're interested in this deluxe content.
I just noticed that we have an illustration of Piccadilly. There's a knee on Morgan's chest and knife in the air, about to drive it into his throat.
It's very, very metal.
Yeah.
Not wanting to labour the point, but yeah. Yeah, that's your cover right there.
That's quite a good Piccadilly as well. He has this sort of tousled boy band hair.
It is quite weird, isn't it? Just a little... Yeah, the ways in which these mice are made slightly more human is often really unsettling.
Piccadilly takes the mouse brass and enters the power station, and Barker watches, whispering, "Everything depends on this now. Get rid of him for us." So Piccadilly enters Jupiter's frozen cathedral, and the great spectral cat face appears. Piccadilly holds up the brass and shouts, "My name is Piccadilly, and by the power of the green mouse, I banish you forever." He flings the charm, but Jupiter's ghostly frozen breath cracks it in midair, sending it plummeting to the floor in fragments. Piccadilly tries to run, but meets the undead army at the door. And that is finally the end of the brave grey mouse. Oh. Beloved Piccadilly.
Yeah. He has a really spirited mouse.
Really spirited mouse.
And no resolution on the Audrey Piccadilly love situation.
No, of course not.
Just immediately. Oh. It's been going on for three books.
Yeah, no, it was just set up to give something to haunt Audrey for the rest of her days.
Yeah.
So Arthur struggles with the injured Thomas Triton back to Deptford, but Thomas is delirious and the agonising frost in his leg is spreading. Arthur shouts for help to the sleeping mice, and Gwen holds Triton by the fire helplessly. The Star Wife appears and proclaims that Triton has the winter sickness unleashed by the spears of Narmoth that Jupiter, has brought back once more. The Star Wife says that they should just kill Thomas to put him out of his misery, but Audrey manages to read on her thoughts that the Star Wife might be capable of healing him, and confronts her. The Star Wife says that she will attempt to save Triton if Audrey will help her. And this is more Star Wife trickery going on here. As the ritual is happening, the Star Wife complains that she's too old and feeble to complete the spell, and right on cue, Audrey rushes forward to offer to hold the silver acorn. And then her power is transferred to Audrey. The ritual is complete, Triton wakes up free of the curse, and Audrey realises that she's been tricked again. That tricksy Star Wife, what's she like?
Almost as bad as Barker.
The Star Wife prepares for her death and builds her ritual in the frozen garden of the Deptford house. And as she's preparing, she's visited by Barker, who isn't Barker, the balmy old mouse, but Balkan, the old god, returned in these end of days. And the Star Wife isn't the Star Wife anymore, but returned to her name when she was a squirrel. We find out there's a black squirrel, the very last of the black squirrels, and her name was Audrey. And so she dies.
And it's very, very sad. This is like the second chapter ending in a horrible death in a row. But actually, one of the things that I noticed as I was trying to flick through to try and remind myself what happened in the second half of this, every chapter, apart from the last one, ends with like the bleakest possible paragraphs imaginable. Like, if you just want to feel bleak for a while, just skip through to the end of each paragraph of this book and just read the final paragraph. It is hard work.
You can make yourself like Ava's bleak book.
Ava's bleak book, and it's just the final paragraphs of Jarvis, Robin Jarvis's books.
Yeah.
But yeah, so Piccadilly's death is, the small body lay motionless on the ground, the face turned heavenwards. Piccadilly's little paw was closed tightly around his mouse brass, kept fastened to his belt. It was the sign of hope, but with his life, that too ended in that dark place. It's sad, it's heavy, it's heavy. And then let's jump to the four Star Wife. Final paragraph again. The snow fell monotonously, and her chin dropped to her breast as she succumbed to the last of the cruel weather. The night grew old, and a stark grey dawn appeared on the horizon. Through a break in the clouds, a slender ray of pale sunlight shone. For a second, it touched the squirrel's cheeks, and all traces of age were smoothed away, but the gap closed, and the beam faded. Even as the light left her face, the figure in the circle of stones gasped and expired. The midwinter death harvested her.
Harvested.
Almost sounds like things are going to be okay for a minute there. There's like a little ray of light, and then it's like, no, you've been harvested by the midwinter death. It's bleak, it's bleak. End of every chapter, so bleak.
Reminds me of there's a lorry for the supermarket Iceland.
Harvested by the midwinter day.
Well, it says this. The
mum's got harvested by the midwinter day.
It has a picture of like frozen peas on it, and it says the slogan is "Fresh as the day they were." ... Bold text. Harvested. And there's just no way to read that isn't incredibly sinister. Anyway. It's a tonal shift. The next day, Thomas Triton fulfills his promise to the Star Wife that he made in the first half of the book, and builds her a funeral pyre to speed her to the green. But...
Whoa, I've just realised that, like...
Yeah?
Does that pyromaniac... Is that because, like, pyre... It's like...
Pyros is fire in... Latin or Greek, I never know which.
Well, you know, don't say that we're not edutaining as well.
I mean, I say it's Latin or Greek. I only believe that because it's one of the gods in Ultima 8 is Pyros. Pyros, Lethos, Stratos, and the other one.
What is Ultimate 8, AJ?
Ultimate 8. Widely considered to be the worst of the Ultima series of role-playing games. It's the only one I played, which I had when I was little. It was a bizarre thing. It had a weird little bug that meant that you could, at one point, you could drop objects from your package onto some lava and it wouldn't burn, and so you could jump onto those very specific bits where you'd like put a blanket down on the lava so that you could get to places you weren't supposed to get to.
Kind of like, you know, playing the children's game with the floor is lava.
Yes, yeah, literally just doing that with a tiny animated knight.
As we're digressing anyway, I'm going to suggest we do texture of the week.
Okay.
Texture of the week. Well, yeah, I mean, it works because my texture is from the...
Wait, come on, we've got to do the jingle.
All right, sorry.
That was good, yeah.
I've done something.
Ava just improvised with a roll of kitchen roll.
Beautiful.
I think I've ruined your kitchen roll.
Ava.
Oh, right, where was I? Yeah, so you've thrown me off. So in my tradition of not really textures that aren't really textures, but like social textures, or like just like there's something very textural to me about like the particular way they describe the Star Wife ambling about and building the ritual circle for herself, that feels like very exactly the texture of my mum pottering about and trying to finish up some task quite grumpily. The Star Wife ambled to the fence and furtively prodded the snow with her stick. "Charts and dreams," she tutted, bending over and foraging in the bare stony soil. "How jealously we guarded them, all those scrolls and tatters of parchment we believed to be so precious. What use were they in the end?" She held up two good-sized rocks and tossed them into her round clearing. "Never trust a prophecy written on paper," she murmured gruffly to herself as she poked about for the more stones. "Some clever so-and-so's bound to have fiddled with it and copied the ruddy thing down wrongly, adding twiddly bits to his own that are completely irrelevant." The Star Wife picked up four more stones and rolled a further one along the ground with her tail. "Oral tradition," she declared, dropping the rocks into the circle and tapping her nails with her forefinger. "Things preserve best from mouth to ear. Should have known that." So the pottering texture of just like...
Pottering texture.
Pottering, it's a texture. It's a texture. It's a mobility texture, isn't it? Ren's got quite a face on me right now. What the fuck are you doing coming on my podcast and ruining my textures?
No, I'm all for expanding textures.
So I just think everything's a texture.
Yeah.
And I kind of blame you for that.
It's kind of, it's a sort of monomania, really.
We're now through, view everything through the lens of texture. It's my grand narrative, if you will.
Hey, textures are my vocation.
Some people are Marxists. Some people are psychoanalysts.
You're a texturist.
Yeah, I'm a texturist.
Texturist. Yeah. Follow my Instagram account. Yeah, textures are my vocation for more textures.
Yeah, those are actual textures. Not the nonsense theoretical textures of these pretentious literary theorists. a Lacanian texture. Oh, I think I broke Adam.
Physical pain.
It's meant to be this break from academia.
Right, Ren. Do you have a texture?
A little delusion rouge on it.
Oh, God, Ren, do you have a texture?
I do. I have a texture. I have a sensible texture. It's about the winter.
Okay.
Deptford was tightly locked in the bleakest night it had ever known. The rooftops glistened with frosty ground glass, whilst icicles spiked and skewered down from the gutters, looking like the eyebrows of some stern ancient creature. There it is.
Oh.
The pavements were smooth, treacherous traps for the unwary, and the roads rivers of black ice. Yes, those are the icy eyebrows I was particularly keen on there.
Ah, yeah. Bristling and... I don't know. Would icy eyebrows, like, would you be able to sort of snap them off?
Yeah, but then they might grow back.
Yeah.
A bit easy to pluck.
True. To be fair, I've kind of cheated with my texture. After all that. I mean, so my texture is from the Deptford Mice Almanac.
Mm-hmm.
And it's from the entry for September the 22nd. I'll quickly note, actually, September the 23rd is the birthday of Thomas Crichton. So, you know, if you're not doing anything this September the 23rd, 2020, raise a tankard of berry brew to our good friend Thomas Crichton. But the entry of September the 22nd reads, "Rats are especially superstitious, and most of them will always carry at least one lucky charm with them. Should a rat approach you in this season, take care. They believe that one of the most effective talismans is a mouse's little toe. Other fortune bringers, as they're called, include hedgehog teeth and toad skins, both of which must be removed while the creature is still croaking or squealing on a moonless night." And the illustration here of a toad skin is one of the most horribly textured drawings. I think it's really quite deeply unpleasant. Like, I don't know what kind of disease this poor toad had, but Jarvis has drawn it incredibly kind of... It looks simultaneously completely dried out and parched, but also kind of bulbous and mottled, and then it's got this sort of horrible black speckling, which looks kind of like mould or mildew. These sort of awful kind of floppy arms and legs. It's really quite unpleasant. Yeah, it looks like something from a Junji Ito manga. Yeah, it's an impressively horrible toad skin. So that's my texture. I might have to take a picture of it. So we can... I might take a few pictures from this book. Because, yeah, they really are brilliant, some of these illustrations.
Okay, so back to the old house in Deptford. The undead army bang on the door, and the mice, led by Triton, flee into the sewer towards Greenwich. They're well on the way when Audrey is suddenly compelled to turn back and go to the garden. She reaches the Great Hall, and there's no sign of the undead army beyond the destruction of their attack. She makes it into the yard, and she sees a single green shoot sprouting from the ash of the Starwife's pyre. She tucks a tiny plant into the waistband of her dress as a symbol that Jupiter has not already won. She's about to sneak back into the grill, but the ghost army are there, slashing their frozen claws at her. She escapes them and runs into the garden, but this is where she encounters our very first victim of Jupiter's ice spear, all the way back in the prologue, the ghost of the peddler, Kemp. He lunges at her with ice spears and starts to strangle her, but in doing so, she drops the silver bell from her tail that she had found broken on the kitchen floor. The sound of the bell is just enough to break through to Kemp for a moment, and he lets go, allowing Audrey to escape. Right back in the prologue, he was going to bring the other bell back to Audrey. Thomas and the rest of the mice are back at the Cutty Sark, and from there they see Jupiter moving at the power station, ready to use the Starglass for the final time. The Phantom Army surround the Cutty Sark, and it looks pretty dire for Thomas. And at this point, we come back to Oswald and the bats. And we catch up with what happened with the Book of Hrethel all that time ago. It turns out that although the pages of the book were empty, Oswald realises that the energy of the spells is still held within the book. And so he makes himself a suit out of the pages of the book and asks Orfeo and Eldritch to fly him into Jupiter's amorphous wintry heart, clad in the magical pages of the book.
I mean, it is quite dark because it is like a kind of like mystical suicide bomb attach, like just strapping magical paper all around him, like in a kind of... Yeah, there's a lot going on in the imagery there.
Yeah.
And the bats are on their journey. They spot the tiny figure of Audrey and half dead from cold in the garden. And a bat called Hathkin swoops down and scoops her up. The bats arrive at the Cutty Sark just as it seems that the mice will be totally overwhelmed and join their forces against the undead army. Oswald starts scrunching up the pages of the book and throwing them at the apparitions, and instead of sailing through them, they hit, being the one thing capable of destroying the ghosts. Orfeo and Eldritch scoop him up to take him to Jupiter at the observatory, and Audrey invokes the power of the Star Wife to insist they take her too. And at the observatory, Oswald plunges into the heart of Jupiter, surrounded by flaming scraps of enchanted paper. But it's not strong enough. And it seems that Jupiter has won.
"Are you ready, Master Pink Eyes?" Orfeo cried. Oswald nodded resolutely. "Yes," he replied with a ferocious shout. "Then a curse on the abomination," screamed Eldritch as they veered down. Jupiter twisted his corpulent bulk around to see what the annoying tiny insects were up to. He held his breath in surprise and apprehension when he saw them come charging at him. The papers of the tatting suit began to glow as they raced towards the devilish monster, and he growled suspiciously. The remains of the Book of Hrethel burst into golden flames around Oswald. Their radiance cut through the dense fog Jupiter wrapped around himself and scorched his wintry eyes. Down plummeted the bats, and Oswald was transformed into a figure of divine majesty as the spells took him over. "Die, carrion of the void," he commanded forcefully. Like a flaming dart, the bats sped towards the great enemy, and a path of gleaming sparks trailed from them. Into Jupiter's heart they plunged. The huge spirit screeched as they speared into him. Golden lightning bristled from his chest, and he rocked precariously on the misshapen dome. "I cannot die," he screamed. "I am Jupiter, Lord of Death." The crackling yellow bolts wrapped around his body, tormenting him with their heat. At once the battle on the Cutty Sark ceased as the ghosts dropped their weapons and the starfire spluttered in their breasts. Thomas stared at the storm-beleaguered hill breathlessly. The fate of the world depended on the outcome of what was happening there. Suddenly, the starfire welled up inside the spectres once more, and all hope died in the midship house. Jupiter raked his claws through his spectral fur, and the flames died. He drew himself up to his full height and laughed harshly. The Book of Hrethel had not been strong enough. From out of this vastness, two brittle-winged shapes flew. Orfeo and Eldritch were covered in the scales of frost. Jerkily, they careered through the air, gliding fitfully on frozen wings. But they were not carrying Oswald. The albino was lost, swallowed by the abyss of the eternal void. The unbeast might had proved too strong a force, and the valiant mouse's sacrifice had been in vain. The attack had failed, and Oswald was no more. Jupiter watched the bats fleeing aimlessly and chuckled to himself, secure in sweet knowledge that nothing could hurt him now. A deadly silence fell. He turned back to the crimson sun and lifted his claw. The starghast blazed and the horrendous spell continued. The sky became livid as the sun turned a sickly purple. Jupiter had won.
So just one main character death after another.
And that's the end of the book, final chapter.
Yeah.
That's it. It's all done. Jupiter wins. And curtain falls.
But sadly, Jarvis's editor insisted that...
I mean, it is. The thing is, it really does... it does manage to do that in the book, because there's so few pages left at this point that, like, you're watching that final confrontation, believing it's the final confrontation. Like, it's really, it really does be like, oh God. It's surprisingly hopeless to have something go that should have worked, fail that badly, that late in the day.
Yeah. Because you're like, you're kind of like, the cat charm won't work again.
Yeah, yeah.
Like,
they spent a lot of time on this MacGuffin, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's going to work, right?
Yeah. But no.
They can't use the MacGuffin from the first book. That would be ridiculous. But they've got the third.
Anyway. But, yeah, okay. I mean, especially as, I mean, Piccadilly and Oswald are both very likeable characters.
Yeah. Mm.
And, I mean, at least, I don't know. I mean, maybe Oswald dies thinking that he's won, hopefully.
I mean, you know, I do get the impression that he knew that he was going to go out doing it. Yeah, I don't know how he thought he could go in wrapped in explosive magic paper and, yeah.
I don't know if his last image is of, you know, Jupiter gloating in ascendance or whether.
Yeah.
I hope not.
Poor Oswald.
Have you got your list of, because I remember last time.
A little roll call of the dead, I do.
Okay,
yes.
Oh, is that how we're gonna end it then?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Audrey, we still have Audrey.
And a few pages left.
And a few pages. She approaches the observatory, carried by Hafkin, but Hafkin's wing is hit by an ice spear, and he falls to the ground, breaking his neck. He dies. And Audrey has to find a way up to the observatory. Back on the ship, the undead army break into the hold where most of the mice are hiding out. Thomas Triton strikes and lunges with a piece of parchment attached to his sword, but eventually he uses it all up. Audrey's just starting to climb the jagged concrete of the power station when she turns to find the undead spectre of Piccadilly. He lunges at her and starts to strangle her, but she implores him to fight the enchantment, and he remembers who she is. And they hear a voice that both of them recognise. It's Arthur Brown, Audrey's dad, Piccadilly's companion from the very, very beginning of the first book. He tells Piccadilly it's time for him to join him, and tells Audrey that he's proud of her. Audrey faces Jupiter, says, "I come to call down my destiny, and it is tall and dangerous." She reaches into her waistband and pulls out the tiny green shoot from the Star Wife's pyre, a shoot that holds the power of spring and represents the green mouse, and it erupts in Jupiter's ghostly stomach in bright white light. And with that, Audrey, our final girl, dooms Jupiter to eternal life, eternally incinerated by the spring but never consumed by it. And with mere page to go, a couple of pages to go, green spring and summer life spreads joyously out over London, and in the hold of the Cutty Sark appears the Green Mouse himself. He hands Oswald's parents a mouse brass in honour of their son, who didn't live to receive his, and it's the sign of courage and bravery. Audrey tells her mother that her father wishes her and Thomas Triton happiness, and so they get married by the Green Mouse himself. The mice go back to the old house in Deptford, but it's been too damaged to live in, so they take their belongings back to the Cutty Sark. Audrey finds the necklace with a little silver acorn and ties it around her neck. For now, she is truly the Star Wife, handmaiden of Orion.
I just want to, now that we've got through all of the horror and death, like my other secret texture of the week that might actually be a texture.
Oh, you let us down one road.
I let us down one road, and now we've got another one, because I just want to say the burst of spring and summer and growth as Jupiter is cursed to this eternal life is just it's just brilliant. Where do I want to start? The infernal spirit realized that this was the end. The mouse had conquered him. He was doomed to be incinerated by the spring till the end of time, but never to be consumed by it. He burst into a terrific, blistering rush of flames and became a towering effigy of fire, and then he rocketed, howling, into the air. Higher and higher he soared into the freezing reaches of space, screeching his suffering and fury. Like a green comet, he shot up, chased by the forces of life through the universe until he was only a faint blur between the stars. Cosigned to the vacuum of the void, he suffered in the agony of spring throughout eternity. Audrey dropped with fatigue, her energy spent. A rosy light glimmered on the horizon as a fresh new day dawned. The golden rays of the reborn sun shone over the dissipating clouds and stretched over the land, ushering in a beautiful morning. The world was awakening fast. The snow dissolved rapidly, and patches of snowdrop freckled grass appeared. The burgeoning greenery flooded over the park. The frost-locked trees thawed, and glowing blossom burst out with vibrant colours. A glorious chorus of grateful birds took flight and soared into the pale blue sky. All the seasons met as summer roses popped open and gave their perfume to the breeze. Fruit swelled on blossom-burdened boughs, and leaves of autumn gold shone in the sweet air. It was a heady sight, and Audrey absorbed it breathlessly. The earth was thanking her and putting forth all its blissful delights in homage. She bowed her head and wept. It's just nice seeing Jarvis's like really gorgeously like thick, rich prose being put to the forces of good for once. Like describing something nice rather than something like horrific or bleak or sad or I don't know.
He can use his forces for good.
He really leans into it and just goes all out with that description, and I really like him for that.
So that's the end.
Hey.
The end of The Final Reckoning and the end of the Deptford Mice trilogy.
And quite a journey.
It has, yeah.
I think next we're just going to have to do like baby's first spooky alphabet or something.
Yeah. This is the epic that has been quite an absorbing challenge.
Yeah, I think hopefully this coming year we can do. I mean, I don't want to besmirch that for Mites, because it's a brilliant feat of writing, and it really is quite astonishingly epic and emotional. But yeah, maybe a few things with rather less plot might be coming up next.
Yeah.
Slightly fewer notes for you to take, Ren.
Yes. I did just want to present, give a roll call of the characters that we've lost throughout this journey, and its extremely high death count. Starting with, of course, Albert Brown, right at the beginning of the first book. Wartle and Jenkin in Fennywald. Madam Akikuyu, of course, at the end of
the Crystal Prison.
At the end of the Crystal Prison. Kemp, the trader. It was a bit of a rough run the edges, but definitely didn't deserve to be speared to death. the star wife, Audrey, Piccadilly, our dear brave grey mouse, the whole community of Holborn, Piccadilly's best friend, Marty, Algie Comfort, died in the Battle of the Cuttysark, Halfkin the Bat, and Oswald. They were good mice, and bats, and squirrels.
I'm not even sure that's everybody.
And rats.
Yeah, well, this is it. We've lost. Not only have we lost like the entire rat population of Deptford at the end of the first book, but then also the entire rat population of London at the end of.
Yeah, I'm worried. I'm worried about the biodiversity loss.
Oh, I didn't even mention the squirrels of of Greenwich.
Yeah. No, they're loads of the squirrels fell.
Well, I will note that these squirrels do go on to have some ascendancy over our mice friends. So obviously, Robin Jarvis couldn't leave things on a wholly positive note. that wouldn't really be in keeping. And so while the Deptford Mice Almanac mostly kind of recounts the books of the Deptford Mice and the Alchemist's Cat, with, you know, little tidbits and sketches from his notebook, etc., it does actually continue the events at the end of the Deptford Mice, and I'm afraid they're not wholly wholly positive for Audrey. So, yeah, Audrey obviously has become the star wife, and the Deptford Mice Almanac is sort of presented by or from the sketchbook journals of Gervais Brightkin, who actually does look a bit like Ricky Gervais, interestingly, in the illustrations, who's a red squirrel and is none too happy, really, about the fact that a mouse rather than a squirrel has become the star wife. And he's not alone in this. You know, this is not wholly approved of by the squirrel community. So the end of the year, December 30th and 31st, end with these entries. A day of revolt. Supported by a host of my grey cousins, led, I might say, by Fitz Montequay, barged into the Star Wife's chamber and tore the silver acorn from about her neck. Then the usurping mouse, as she was called, was driven away, pelted with empty acorn shells and shot at with arrows. Oh, the outrage, the defaming insult! Then did the strange Morella ascend to the living throne, and the amulet was put about her throat. A black squirrel once more holds the highest office. And now I know why she appears familiar, and why the true Star Wife delayed any action against her and her scheming father. In her face, Morella is very like the young Alison Sedge. Surely there is some devilment here. What is to become of us all now? And then on the 31st, on this last day of the year and my final entry in this almanac, I must try to look to the future with hope. It is said that the passing year represents an old friend who is giving way to the new infant of tomorrow. How appropriate that belief is now with the Star Wife gone. What sinister darkness lies ahead for us all? Audrey Scuttle was placed upon the living throne by the Green himself. A madness has consumed the folk of Greenwich, and I fear for what will undoubtedly befall them. A dismal, unpleasant place has this become, and I shall not spend the eve here. Farewell now. Oft it is repeated that dire perils and uneasy times unite old enemies. I am now going to prove the truth of it, for I am away to the Cuttysark to patch up my quarrels and cruise this darksome night with Thomas Triton. May the reader of this almanac fare better than I in the days to come.
Oh no!
Oh dear!
So,
So Alison Sedge turns into a black squirrel. So,
Alison Sedge, possesses, I think, a black squirrel.
Yeah.
And ascends the throne and usurps poor Audrey.
Wow.
Gosh.
So,
I didn't see that coming.
No.
Wow, I didn't even think Alison. I can't believe they managed to get more judgmental about Alison Sedge. We get it, Robin. You're a bit, you don't like a fab. It's all right. Anyway, sorry.
I mean, you know, hopefully...
What an epilogue.
My old pal Audrey is okay. I mean, she's driven off by acorns and arrows, but I rather suspect she goes on to become a kind of Madame Akakuyu figure.
Yeah.
Hmm.
So, wow.
Well.
On that bombshell.
On that bombshell.
Should we have the credits?
Yeah, thank you everyone for accompanying us on this epic journey through the Deptford Mice, and thank you very much, Ava.
Yeah, thank you, Ava.
became rather more extended than we expected.
Yeah, it was quite the commitment from you, and thanks for all your reading.
No, I'm really, really happy to have done it.
And
slowed us down a few times.
No, and especially your reading of Jupiter, which was magnificent.
And you can find Ava at Ava Foxfort on Twitter.
And Instagram.
Our Twitter is at StillScaredPod. You can email us at StillScaredPodcast@gmail.com. It's been so long since I've done the credits, I've forgotten. Our intro is by Maki Yamazaki. Our outro is by Joe Kelly. Our artwork's by Letty Wilson. All their details are in the show notes. A full transcript will be in the show notes as well. And
we wish you a happy 2020. And, you know, if you're British and the horizons are looking rather bleak, hopefully they're not, but they quite possibly are. You know, remember the example of the plucky Deptford mice who braved through the bleakest winters.
They did.
Let's call down our destiny and let's
hope the green mouse can save us.
Yeah. See you next time, spooky kids, wherever we may be.
And may the green keep you safe, and a happy new year to you all.
Speed to the green.
Bye.
Bye.
I mean, I hope Boris gets, you know, consumed by green flame shoots through a limit attempt.